Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
Good evening, and welcome to this public affairs special from KQED Public Radio. I'm Mark Trotwine. Tonight's program is a recording of the American Graduate Forum, presented by KQED and held at Laney College in Oakland on Tuesday evening, March 13th. This program focuses on high school students and their high rate of dropping out of high school before graduation. Here, then, is Glenn Washington, the host and moderator of the American Graduate Forum, presented by KQED.
Thank you so much, John, for that wonderful introduction. And I want to thank as well Dr. Webb, Chris Boskin, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the teachers who are here today. I can't tell you how happy this makes me. It feels like a homecoming of a type. I used to work in creating the wraparound services for schools at the Center for Young Entrepreneurs at Haas until about 3 years ago. And then I did do that leap into public media. And the first place I came, I was looking for a young, diverse, educated crowd of students to speak to. And the very first place we came was Laney College, right here. And so I haven't been back to this auditorium since, but it's so wonderful to be back and to talk about such a serious issue. It was about 4 or 5 years ago when we were working on various wraparound service programs that I spoke to then-Mayor Jerry Brown. I spoke to Mayor Brown, and he was very happy with himself because he told me that he was going to double the amount of African-American males that graduate equipped to go on to university. And I thought, that's fantastic. That's great news. What's the number right now? And he said 30. And I couldn't believe it. When I looked into it, it did seem to be that we were in a crisis of epic proportions. And I know that each and every one of you are dealing with the front lines of that. And we can't wait to get some of the thoughts that you have today. Now, you know, you've seen this before. If you have a phone, please take it out. And I want to say, please turn it to vibrate. But what you might not appreciate is that, no, don't put it away. We're going to have three different ways to participate in tonight's discussion. The one is going to be the mobile platform. You're going to be able, mobile polling is going to be happening tonight, and some of you have already signed up for that. If you're on Twitter, the hashtag is AMGrad, American Grad. It's AMGrad. And, of course, we're going to have microphones set up around the auditorium here tonight, and we'll have someone as well going around to get your comments. We want this to be as participatory as possible. You are going to make this forum. We've got some wonderful people with a lot of knowledge here tonight. Now, I am really, really thrilled to introduce this fabulous panel we have coming up here. And we're going to go right down the row and have each of the panelists speak for about 3 minutes before we open it up to a broader conversation. And we get to start with Cesar Cruz. He's a native of Mexico. He's been an educator for 17 years in the U.S., and he is a brother that you don't want to mess with. He fasted once for 26 days for education and scored a victory worth millions for West Contra Costa educational system. He operated an independent school out of his home called the Making Changes Freedom School, which operated for 3 years, and he currently serves as the co-founder of the youth development organization Homies Empowerment Program, Cesar Cruz.
I begin with a poem. You wonder why I drink, do drugs, steal, rob, and kill? You wonder why I never cared about your opportunities? You wonder why I'll never enlist in the service? You wonder why I dropped out of high school? You wonder why we're always poor? You wonder why we're always pregnant? You wonder why we're always in jail? Well, I wonder why there's a liquor store on every block in my neighborhood. I wonder why the FBI and the CIA would want us addicted to crack. I wonder why if I steal a slice of pizza and it's strike three in California, I get life imprisonment. But if you're Enron or a multinational corporation, you get a pardon or a bailout. I wonder why they're still teaching that Lincoln freed the slaves and Columbus discovered us. This young man said that education is liberation, but for us, schooling is incarceration. I wonder why News at 11 had my mother as the top story as a welfare queen when we all know that the largest recipients of corporate welfare are these multinational corporations. America, I wonder how it is that you even blame us for the problems that you helped to create. I wonder. Don't you? Gracias and good evening.
It's going to be a good panel.
I have 2 minutes, so I'll keep it brief. Young people need to know that you have their back at all times. And it's not conditional love, but unconditional love. They do not care what you know. They need to know that you care. That's number one. Number two, you begin to move on to creative culture where the third eye can open up and envision something new. Because a lot of us carry trauma of rape, of incest, of murder, of violence, of 183 liquor outlets in East Oakland and not one bookstore. That is criminal before a single trigger is pulled. And so you got to understand that as an educator. You got to stand alongside those that have the leash. You got to live in the hood, live in the barrio, be about the barrio, and not feel sorry for young people, but stand with young people to create another world. And you need to take them to places like Barrios Unidos in Santa Cruz where peace is possible, Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles where peace is possible, and you need to educate them with liberation books. I wrote a book called Bang for Freedom, and it's a history book for La Raza, for kids that don't like to read, to teach them the truth. And when they hear about women like Rigoberta Menchú, whose father was killed, whose brothers were killed, and then they meet her. We brought Rigoberta Menchú in an organization called Homies Empowerment that I'm thankful to represent. We brought her into the hood so that traumatized kids can meet traumatized leaders who are changing the world and won a Nobel Peace Prize so that they see their future and they envision that a new world is possible. Young people at any age can serve others. When 14-year-olds start finding out about the conditions of prostitutes, the conditions of day laborers, you had young people who started a day labor breakfast program, and they've been giving breakfast every Monday morning for 3 years in Oakland, California, and they continue to do so. Then young people need to see themselves as the heroes and sheroes in their community. I've been told to stop, so this is the last thing I'll say. Every time a young person walks into the room, that's Dolores Huerta, that's Lolita Lebron, that's Heidi Santa Maria, that's Malcolm X. I have the future revolutionary right in front of me, so I have a revolutionary duty to spark the mind and to help create change. That is my role as an educator.
Teachers. Teachers, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. Our next panelist is Dr. Kimberly Mayfield. She's the first African-American tenured associate professor and chair of the education department at the Holy Names University in Oakland, California. She's a former special education teacher and has taught and supervised teachers in urban and suburban districts for 11 years. Dr. Kimberly Mayfield.
Thank you. Good evening. The stability of the teaching force directly impacts student engagement, attendance rates, and graduation rates. I've been an educator for 22 years. I started out as a special education teacher in the Oakland Unified School District. The climate for new teachers in the early 90s was much different than it is right now. The majority of my colleagues were veteran teachers and had been at my school site for at least 10 years or more. The principal, the school district, and the nation seem to understand that teaching is a developmental craft. I had the latitude to grow as a beginning professional, and for the most part, I had the supplies I needed, access to materials at the school site and at the district level, and I was a product of the school district that I taught in and lived in the same community, and I still do. I had insider knowledge, a lot of what Cesar is talking about, and it wasn't acquired as part of my credential program. Now, the climate for new teachers is very different, and I see Cicely Day in the audience, who's a new teacher. I want to acknowledge her because she is exactly the kind of teacher that I'm going to talk about that we need, someone who is part of the Oakland community, local, permanent, and diverse. The climate for new teachers has changed drastically from when I entered the profession. The imposition of the business model on education and various implementations of education reform have unhinged the profession and expectations of new teachers. New teachers are no longer given a chance to grow in the profession. There is an assumption that they're perfect in every aspect of the teaching profession when they enter the classroom. And if they are not, they are vulnerable to lose their jobs after the first year. I don't know about you, but I don't know who was an expert after 1 year, and I don't know who was an expert after the first 6 weeks of teaching, when decisions begin to be made around the stability of the teaching force that our children experience in Oakland. Access to basic classroom materials is questionable, and some people think that a 2-year commitment is all you need to make concrete changes in the educational experiences of our children. The high percentage of high school dropouts lets us know that more is needed. Now, many of these differences are based in the unrealistic expectations of No Child Left Behind, ongoing conversations regarding education reform, and the current rhetoric and assessment used to identify effective teachers. Okay, I have to stop now. What I want to say is help is on the way. Programs like Teach Tomorrow in Oakland require that teachers make a 5-year commitment to our kids, that they are local, they are permanent, and they are diverse, and we know that this is going to help change the high dropout rate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mayfield. And now our next panelist is Dave Orfel, and he's a teacher and small learning community coordinator at Skyline High School in Oakland, California. Much of his free time, he serves as a member of the Center for Teaching Quality's Bay Area New Millennium Initiative and Teaching 2030 teams. Let's hear it for Dave Orfel.
Well, I got to start off by saying I'm really humbled to be on the stage with some giants and luminaries, or dare I say some titans of the education community. It's a good day to be a titan. I think that Cesar spoke to it in his talk, and it's also the very first piece of advice I ever got 15 years ago when I began my teaching career. A colleague of mine who I respected greatly said that children do not care what you know until they know you care. And in those last 15 years, I've seen education fads come and go. I've seen whole literacy replaced by phonics, replaced by whole literacy, replaced by phonics again. I've seen best practices prove that last year's best practices weren't really best practices. But in all that time, I've never not seen relationships be important. And I think that both for the dropout rate of children that we're here talking about tonight, and the dropout rate of teachers that my colleague just eloquently talked about, that the solution is quite similar. That relationships and humanity are keys to solving both dropout rates. And unfortunately, for the last 10 years, the American education system has been going the exact wrong way. That the over-focus on basic skills and the under-focus on creativity and connectivity and collaboration, the three C's of the 21st century, that the over-focus on basic skills, the judging of schools by these basic skills, Now the judging of teachers by these basic skills, and coming to a college campus near you, the judging of schools of education based on these basic skills, is taking us in the exact wrong direction. It's further isolating the teacher in the classroom. It's further dumbing down the curriculum of the student. And for both the teacher and for the student, school's a lot less fun than it used to be. And I think that turning this ship around and racing headlong towards creativity, collaboration, and connectivity, we can address both of these dropout problems in America. Because I think that when school's a lot more fun again, teachers are going to want to stay, and students are going to want to stay. And the longer we stay, and the longer we stay together, the better the relationships we will form. Thanks for coming out tonight.
Wow. Our next panelist, Jose Diaz Jr. He's been engaged in refining the role of science in communities of color. He started his career in Los Angeles and San Diego, and he's always been engaged in building those relationships between community and school. He brings a wide range of experiences to Oakland that he uses to relate difficult concepts. And he's the director right now of the and teacher in the Green Academy of Oakland Technical High School, which focuses on the intersection of science, social issues, and the environment. Jose.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Josue. Jose, there's a U. Everyone, again. It's all right. It's okay. So, like Lynn said, I started off my career in Los Angeles, went to San Diego for a few years, and now I find myself here in Oakland. And there's one thing that I pretty much saw in common in all three different districts, and that's pretty much how I find myself predicting and able to predict the success of certain students. It's actually a sad reality, if any. It's really saddening to know that I can go into a school, and in the first week, just by talking to students, they themselves know, and they tell me which track they're on. And it's so sad to know that schools know this, and they, you know, we discuss, and we have PDs, and we have, more discussions on the dropout rate, but no one really steps up and does something about it. And it's really disheartening that at times to know that students come into your class, first day of school this year, students knew, I'm not in this track. And it could be whatever name. I mean, some districts have different names for everything. We have tracking. It used to be called tracking. Now it's ability grouping. And now it's something else. I mean, it's the same thing. You may not, it's there. You know, we don't want to call it. We sometimes don't even want to say that it exists because nobody wants to get their hands dirty with who started it. But it really doesn't matter. It's there. And we do have tracks. And we do have these pathways that students know whether they're going to be on a college pathway or a vocational pathway or through the dropout pathway. And they know this already coming into high school. So at Oakland Technical High School this year, we actually started AP programs for students that are not traditionally in the AP track. And we kind of realized that it doesn't just take money and programs for students just to be successful. You can't just expect, here's some money, here's some programs, there it goes. Just like my colleague said, it's hard work. They need to know that you're there for them. You know, this is the first year that we have teaching AP Environmental Science for the majority of students of color. And it's not just, they're in an AP class, you guys can do it. An analogy that my wife gave me today was the fact that, you know, someone who's never been near a swimming pool, you can't just throw them in the pool and expect them to swim. You know, you got to give them little floaties, you got to give them some classes, you got to show them what's going on. And that's what we're doing now. Me and myself and other teachers at our school and with working with these students of color in these AP programs, we offer Saturday tutoring. We meet up at a local cafe, talk about the community, and we show them how to study for an AP exam. You know, we actually have tutoring once a week after school. We communicate with our students through email, text, phone calls. I mean, you name it. We are there for them, and they're there for us because I have learned so much, and from my students. And I would not be able to do half of the stuff that I'm doing if I'm not listening to my students. And I think that's one thing as teachers, we're so overwhelmed with what we got to do and all the pressures and everything that the school is asking and the demands of what society is asking us to do. But sometimes we just got to stand still. Maybe even sit sometimes, and just listen to our students because they'll tell you what's wrong. They'll tell you what's needed. They'll tell you exactly what's the obstacle for them to achieve whatever they want. And I think that's one thing that teachers definitely need to do, just sit down and listen to our students, because just like here, we can talk with ourselves and all, but the students know, and it's ultimately we do this for them. So thank you. I think that's my time.
Josue Diaz. And our last final panelist is Betsy Schultz. And Betsy is a veteran educator for the past 39 years. Betsy has been a teacher and counselor at the Zapata Street Academy, an outgrowth of the Civil Rights Movement. This street academy serves a population of urban, multicultural youth of Oakland, many at risk of failure in school, and provides a college prep education while emphasizing community service, diversity appreciation, and a strong commitment to social justice. Betsy Schultz.
Thank you. As he said, I've been a teacher at Street Academy now for 39 years. The Street Academy is a small alternative high school committed to preventing students from dropping out or being pushed out of the education system via race, class, and other inequalities in education, in our society, and in the world, while at the same time providing a high-quality education for the students, trying to assure their academic success. Our students are not just a number at the Street Academy. They come into an atmosphere of challenging, nurturing, supportive, tough love, and high expectations. Students come to school for many reasons. Some just prefer an alternative to the large traditional schools in Oakland. Some have fallen behind in earning their credits, want a chance to catch up. Others have dropped out of school for a myriad of reasons and want to return to school. Many are referred as being identified as at risk of dropping out, referred by counselors, friends, probation officers, families. We have some third-generation students at the school now. That they're not thriving, that people are worried about them, they send them to us. Some are in foster care or group homes. Some have had chronic truancy and disciplinary problems. Many attend school just to get away from violence and gangs that they encounter in the other schools. Students enter the school, obviously, with a lot of academic deficiencies resulting from inconsistent schooling. Almost none are proficient in the core academic skills and are at risk of dropping out and the resulting problems that would result from that. We were originally designed as a school where at-risk students can have a second chance at succeeding, and that's what we've endeavored to do for the last 39 years. How do we do this? Kind of echoing what everybody said, I think the primary thing is relationships. Key to our program is our CTM model. CTM stands for Counselor, Teacher, Mentor. Every one of us, besides being academic teachers, are also a CTM, and that's considered just as important a role as being an academic teacher. We meet with students and parents at least 3 times a year. We make the phone calls home if the student is absent, not doing what they need to do in classes, behaving badly, or doing great. We try to make those good phone calls, too. We meet with the students twice a day, monitoring their progress, being available to them. We schedule their classes each term. We're big brother, big sister, best friend, worst enemy, surrogate parent, whatever they need, a significant other adult in their lives. We have 5 core principles at the school, which I think are important, that I want to emphasize: unity, respect, responsibility, academic achievement, and community involvement. Unity. We draw students from all over Oakland and, in fact, the whole East Bay. And we emphasize to our students when they come into the school that they're entering the Street Academy family and are to leave behind the divisiveness of the outside world. We celebrate our diversity through our unity. We do this through respect. We have a metamorphosis class that all new students take their first quarter to learn about respect, conflict resolution, diversity appreciation, and ultimately, that success depends on themselves, that it is their responsibility. Ours is a tough love program, and we also stress academic achievement. We are not a continuation school. We have the ADG requirements for going on to a 4-year college. A large percentage of our students do go on to college, 4-year college and community college. We also stress community involvement. Our students do 120 hours of participation and service as part of their graduation requirements. And last but not least, we all know the saying, it takes a village, and our village is very important to us. We couldn't do it without all the support from our partner agencies that we work with to provide mentoring and role models and everything else that our students need. Thank you.
Thank you very much, panelists. Now, I want to get started with some of the questions. I'm going to ask you, I know this is kind of impossible, but to limit your answers to around 90 seconds because there's so many people who do want to engage with you. But I'm going to ask you a very difficult question first. It's really two questions. We're talking about the dropout crisis. And I wonder from your vantage point whether or not you feel that the community feels that we are in a crisis. Is this a crisis? Is this the community response to a crisis situation? And I guess I would ask that, too, about the education community. Do you feel that the education community itself is actually engaged in crisis planning? And I know you all have a lot to say. Cesar, I'm going to start with you.
I think American education is doing fine and well. I think American education was created to have loyal, patriotic sponges. I don't think there's a crisis in American education. I think that these are dropout factories. They're not street academies. Street academy is the exception. But these high schools, especially in Oakland, California, have been producing dropout rates and push-out rates for decades. They know what they're doing. You need poor people. You need people that are willing to take any kind of job. You need American citizens that are not critical thinkers. And so I don't think there's a crisis in education. I think the educational system is working fine and dandy. It is creating mental slavery.
Dr. Mayfield.
I think that, as Cesar said, this is business as usual. So for some people, it doesn't feel like a crisis. It feels like it's just what's been happening. But for the people who think critically about what's going on, we know that it's a crisis, and we're crying out for change. And so one of the things that has been a catalyst for change in the last 4 years was the task force process under the former mayor, where he said Oakland citizens have the genius to solve Oakland problems. So one of the things I did was co-convene the Effective Teachers for Oakland Task Force, because we knew that there was something wrong with the schools for our children. So I think that some citizens do know it's what to do about it, and it's really agitating the powers that be, because what we're seeing is status quo at a fever pitch.
When you say there's something wrong with the schools for our children, that sounds like there's something wrong with the people in those schools. What do you really mean by that? What's wrong?
There's something wrong with the system of education. When I was in school, I knew the names of the schools. The schools have changed. Oaklanders know a lot of things have changed in Oakland. Some of us refer to the street that is called International as what? East 14th, right? So when you use the term education reform to really destroy a district, to sort and blow up schools and put them back together and give them new names, you're really destroying community history, community knowledge. So the something that's wrong is that we have people teaching our kids who don't know anything about them. And that's like this intuition that the community knows. When you walk into a school and everybody is new at their job, from the principal to the kindergarten teacher to the second grade teacher, even like the custodians, we know there's something wrong. Because when everybody is new at their job, there's a lot of disharmony, a lot of ambiguity, and a lot of people don't know what they're doing. And what ends up happening is they go lockstep with the curriculum that they've been given, that Dave so eloquently described as merely teaching the basic skills so people can be good workers and not think critically.
Dave, you spoke about relationships as being key to improving the situation the good doctor spoke of. How do you build those, given the context that the teachers have to operate in?
Well, I think, first of all, like a lot of teachers, I'm in it for the money. And and I think that, you know, As much as I was into the rap that kicked us off today, I think that teachers, with tongue in cheek, like, we really do want more money, but we don't want more money for our pockets. I mean, we'd love to have enough to keep the landlord off our back, but what we really want is more money for our kids. I think that most of us really want to have a compelling and optimistic vision that we really can succeed. And it seems like too often the system and the cards are stacked against our kids. I mean, I don't think it's... I think if you take a look at the numbers, it's disappointingly not surprising that that even in the Bay Area in California in 2012, our schools are organized by color, that the impoverished schools are predominantly black and brown, and the schools that don't have to worry about the high-stakes testing, that don't have to worry about mandates coming down from the state, those are schools out in the suburbs that are predominantly still white.
Josue, you've been working and trying to teach science to some of those brown kids, and this is, it seems like, be the last frontier. It seems to be one of those things that doesn't get done. And when you look at the statistics on science achievement by black and brown kids, it's very, very poor. But you seem to have had some success. How do you do it?
I showed my students the truth. I showed them data. I showed them what they're up against. One example was in the beginning of my environmental science class, I showed my students a report on the success rates on AP environmental science exam for students of color. I showed them, this is what you're up against, and we talk about it. I'm trying to wrap my head around everything. Just talking to them. I think one of the things is knowing where they're coming from, knowing where the knowledge that I have as well, my experiences, matching that up, and seeing that we're working together. I never put myself in a position where I'm always talking to them, whereas we're working together towards a common goal. It's just very, I get all emotional here with my students and all. It's a struggle. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of extra time on top of everything that we're asked to do. And my students definitely know this. And I always ask them to put in the work as well, because it's an overwhelming system that we have to overcome. And we're not going to change it overnight or anything like that. But something to help my group out will definitely come together once we work together.
We need you to work harder, teachers. We're going to break up the event right now. We've got some, it's really interesting how so many of you have spoken about the stereotypes that seem to still be playing a major role in how we see, view, and educate. And we've got some kids coming up right now who are going to break a few of those stereotypes. I'm thrilled. I saw these guys earlier. Gregory Belding and Kwojo Nore, they are part of the Bay Area Urban Debate League, and they're going to give us a little taste of what they do. Come on up.
Okay. Well, first and foremost, I just want to say that everything that I've heard so far is right on the money with how I feel as a student in this education system. I just want to move forward from there. First and foremost, I think that students need
Wait. His name is Kwojo Moore. My name is Greg Belvin.
Oh, yes.
Kwojo Moore.
Thanks,
Greg Belvin.
As people have said, students need to be made to feel that that they are in charge of their education, that their voice matters. Like, if you don't feel that your voice matters in this system, you're not going to want to partake in it. Even adults feel that way. So expecting a student to feel differently makes no sense. The first thing I think that is the main issue is that students don't feel that education for them is meaningful. They don't see how it links to their own environment. How does this math or this science linked to what I do on the street, how I live on the streets, or wherever I live? The biggest issue is, in my personal opinion, Emancipatory learning. That's something that I feel needs to happen. Students need to be given a chance to take control and take charge of what they learn. And I feel that the best way to do that is by involving them in teaching not only other students within their classroom, but themselves, because the best way to learn is to teach.
Thank you, sir. I'd like to echo Mr. Orfall and say that it's a great day to be a Titan. My name's Greg Belvin. I go to Skyline High School. I'm a senior. And here's what I got to say. My high school was underfunded. After-school programs just wasn't in the budget. Positive role models, it just wasn't. Man, me and all my big brothers just be getting blunted. I had to make my private life public so that those tuning in could pay attention to the subject. Community we need, because in my life, that's what's really missing. Which in turn puts me in one of those awkward positions where I could understand how those gangs could be appealing, because us inner city children just be searching for that feeling of camaraderie. And so we hanging out with menaces, committing petty crimes for very small dividends. Unless by happenstance you turn into a kingpin, but even then you at the bottom of the pyramid. I want to climb and let my school reap the benefits. I hold it down for the 99%. There's a few numbers that I want you guys to be aware of. I believe 4 out of every 10 high school students in Oakland are not getting diplomas, meaning that they're dropping out. I think there's students who aren't even included in that number, that 4 out of 10, who are, you know, probably getting pregnant, probably going to jail. I guess 271 out of every 100,000 youth are locked up or going to jail. And once you go to jail, once you get out, there's like a 91% chance that you go back, which kind of kills your chances for graduating high school. And I only say those two numbers to say this, that there are disenfranchised youth whose voices are marginalized in the status quo. This is important. You got to understand this. Because hearing their voices is a prerequisite to any policy option to correct the situation. And now I'm going to turn it back over to my friend.
Okay, so according to a report by OUSD, around 54% and 56% of African-American Latino students, respectively, are graduating from high school, compared with 79% and 75% of Asian-American and white students. Now, part of this reason, I feel, is because of funding issues and things of that nature. But I also feel that in large part, it's because of a cultural reason. Things that are taken for granted in certain schools and certain environments are not being done or not even being addressed when it comes to African-American Latino students. There's a history behind them. There's things that they deal with every single day that are, under any circumstances, similar to the things that happen in a suburban area. And I feel that the main thing that needs to be done for them is to allow them to teach other students. Now, this would work by a teacher setting aside time in the classroom for them to get in front of other students and teach. This wouldn't happen, oh, we're going to pick the best and brightest student. Oh, hey, Jimmy, come up here. Come teach these guys. No, this is real. We're going to pull up students who are not doing well in class. We're going to pull these students in front of them. This teacher is going to be a part of the process. The teacher is not going to take a leadership role. The teacher is going to take a guiding role. The teacher is going to help to bring out the voice and the inner intelligence, the potential intelligence and knowledge of that student, and help to transform this into kinetic intelligence and knowledge. Because students have knowledge within themselves, and it only needs to be brought out. You don't have to force anything on a student. They are willing and able to learn, provided they have the environment to do so.
With much respect to my colleague, Quojo Moore, for the sake of debate, I would like to just draw out these contrasts for the audience. He's proposing that we have students stand up for 20 minutes, you know, I guess a few times out the week, and let their voices be heard, which is a great idea, I guess, if the object is just to let kids' voices be heard. But I feel like that's only a microcosm to what my plan is, or what I'm proposing today, which is that the student governments from these schools would like start a research project to just get the voices and get the ideas and get the narratives of those who are excluded in those numbers that I talked about earlier. And I believe that this is a prerequisite to doing any policy option, because when you exclude those voices of those who are already being marginalized by the current system, that means that whatever information you get, whatever policy option that you want to implement, it's only going to help those who are still in that system and who was able to function in that system in the first place. I mean, that's fine if you guys agree with that. But even if you don't, like, seriously, like, I mean, there, when you exclude people's voices and you don't let them speak for themselves, you allow these numbers, like, 4 out of 10 to speak for them. And when you restrict somebody's being to a number, that dehumanizes them. And I don't know if you guys understand the weight of that. But when you dehumanize an entire population of youth, that constructs them as disposable. That means that, yes, we can put drugs in this community and crime in this community because these kids are numbers. They're 4 out of 10 dropping out of school. We need to know their voices so that we don't base our policy options on false assumptions. And with that, I want to turn it back over to my friend.
So I wholeheartedly agree with Greg's assessment of what needs to be done for students. However, in this situation, I'm trying to focus on what can we do in classrooms here today without having to go through bureaucracy, without having to go through politics, without having to go through all these other issues. Yes, it is important for students to have their voices heard and for us to get the voices of those who are being marginalized. We need to do that. However, in this situation, we're talking about what can we do with schools? What can the schools themselves do? What can the teachers within the classroom do? What kind of a difference can they make in the day-to-day life of a child in that situation right then and there? And building a research project is important. That needs to be done. However, what about the students that are going to be graduating this year? What about the students who aren't going to be graduating? What about those who are on the cusp? We need to help the students who are on the cusp of leaving the school system and dealing with that issue. Once we start working towards a solution in the here and now, then we can begin to pull in information about what's going on. Because honestly, thank you.
That we got to get the kids' voices heard, and it can't be done within a classroom context. The teachers are doing their job, but these kids are lacking the social skills and the truth as a foundation to be able to even function in these classrooms. So the answer is not going to happen in a classroom, I believe. You believe that it will, and I believe that we'll find out.
Oh, okay.
You guys are amazing. Let's give a big round of applause for these young men. Lucidate just on the issues. Thank you both very, very much. Thank you. You heard them. Take those stereotypes and put them somewhere. Now, we have just a short period of time to further engage the panelists. I want to make sure that people get a chance to ask their questions. And there's going to be a microphone going around. And you see both of the microphones that are fixed. So could we start with you in the back?
Okay. Hi. This is a room full of rebels. We are all here for a number of causes, but our students are too often rebels without a cause. And I promise you, you're going to be glad to hear what I have to say. My name is Lauren. I'm here from Good School Food, Good School Wet Food, thank you, .org. And you're in luck because I'm a bearer of very good tidings that you won't hear anywhere else. Info that will make you happier and healthier and your students too. I have a question. If there's a little context you need to hear though. I have, this is about the achievement gap. I'm a teacher too. I taught in Sacramento and Vallejo. Parents blame the teachers. The teachers blame the parents. Oh, they don't have enough books in their house. They don't come to teacher meetings. There's a lot of blame going around. The reason I want each of you to take the info flyer about vitamin D is that public health agencies, local, state and national are not doing a thing about it. This is going to be a grassroots revolution to get kids having enough D. 70% on average don't have enough. 80% Latino, 90%. 9 out of 10 African-American kids do not have enough vitamin D. I've called KQED every time there's something on there on the forum. I send in my little email and they don't read it. So this is the kids that your school can have, I'm getting there, can have fewer absences, less asthma, stronger immunity so they can fight off the flu, lower rates of obesity and diabetes. I have a friend who's a junior in high school who's got high blood pressure. His mom put him on vitamin D. It's down. D also reduces depression. Suicide is the third chief cause of suicide for teenagers.
Thank you very much.
The question is,
to keep moving on.
I know. I'm almost done. KQED has Mark Hyman on there talking about vitamin D. But what about our kids in our schools? What do you think we can do to get this information where it's going to make a difference? I'm not worried about the Whole Foods shoppers. I'm worried about the kids in my classes, that I teach.
Thank you very much, panelists. Well, yeah, I think that was some very good points on getting nutrition into our school system. Could we have a next person who wants to say something? And we have a question here as well. Please go ahead.
My name is Joy Moore. I'm a garden and cooking instructor at Berkeley Technical Academy, which used to be a continuation high school. I wanted to ask how the panelists think we can educate children when we lie to them and they know we're lying. For one, we say that money isn't everything. Money is everything in this country. We need to face that. Two, we hear all the time people say, oh, we can't just throw money at the problem, it'll go away. We haven't tried that. Let's throw money at the problem. And finally, when the students come to school, they don't see themselves reflected in the administration and the running of the school. What do they aspire to? What do they aspire to? They see custodians in food service, African and Latino workers, but they don't see administrators that look like them running the school. And then the last thing I want to ask you, and I'll leave it go after that, how can we expect a great education when we don't even pay our teachers a living wage? It's a lie when we say we care about education. Education is a priority. We must have education, but yet we won't even pay the people who are doing it. We are the ones who have the future of this country in our hands. When these children come into our schools, we have to acknowledge that this system is designed to fail a lot of kids. It's just as Caesar said earlier, the system, the public education system, is designed to keep the masses of the people down, and we need to face that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Panelists, who wants to take that one?
Well, I think it's really interesting that the education reformers that use those slogans, like we can't just throw money at the problem, and money's not the solution, and I think the new one is don't let poverty be an excuse, right? It's always really interesting to see, one, where they went to school, and two, where they're sending their kids to school. And often, folks like Secretary Arnie Duncan has never seen the inside of a public school classroom except as a photo op.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Dr. Patricia Nunley, and I'm from the 100 Black Men of the Bay Area Community School that's opening in the fall. So what I would like for you panel members, thank you so much, is to answer this. Why are we calling it dropout when it's really push out?
Thank you very much. This is going to be the last question for right now.
All right. What's the bottom line? Is it success or keeping our youth out of prison? Because I know my compadre here, Cesar, I think since we started working in the public schools here in Oakland, you know, we've buried our kids, you know, like each year. I know you've been burying kids every year, man, like ever since I've known you. And just recently we saw one of our students from East Oakland Community High, was sentenced a prison term, a life term in prison about a few weeks back. So if is it success, then how can that be taught or experienced if the educator, because of their income or lack of resources, does not feel or know or understand success? How can that be taught? Or is it prison or a violent fate? Because if that's the case, then how can we imagine what it would take to not just save our schools, but save our brothers, our sisters, our kids, the ones that we're burying, man?
Panelists, would someone like to take that? Cesar.
I think that we have to be clear that violence is big money. Every time we bury a child, the coroner's office makes some money. The police department makes some money. Funeral homes make money. Places that sell roses and cemeteries make money. And so there really is no need to stop the violence because violence is big money. And The person that spoke earlier is right, that we've never really thrown money at the problem. We threw it at GM, we threw it at Ford, we threw it at banks, but we've never really thrown it at education. Where I would respectfully disagree is that I don't think money is a solution. I grew up not in this country, so I have a different perspective. I grew up in Mexico, and we didn't have a lot, but we were creative, we were inventive, and we found ways to plant seeds regardless, even if the soil wasn't fertile. And so it's figuring out ways to create fertile soil. Yes, we're going to take on the system. Yes, we're going to take on these inequities, but we can't just wait for money to come down from the government. However, the majority of us are taxpayers, and every time we shop, we're taxpayers, and we haven't had a movement that says no taxation without representation. And if we continue to have prison schools, at some point we need an economic boycott of prison schools, of all the funding that's going to prisons, so that we no longer send our taxes to the incarceration of our children.
Thank you very much, Cesar. Could we just get a big round of applause for this panel? And we'd like to thank you so very, very much. It's been an amazing picking your brain. Please, thank you very, very much. And right now, we'd like to take some of the themes that we've heard today. They're going to pop up here on our screen and run them by you and see what you think about them. Some of the things that came up a lot in today's discussion. This first question is, what primary factors influence kids to stay in school? And we have mentorships, 21st century skills, high expectations, and effectively engaging teachers. Which one of these makes any sense to you as an educator? What do you really think is behind effectively engaging these kids?
On the mentorship piece, I get a little concerned if you mean mentor as a white female, because when you look at the mentoring programs for black boys, again, remember I have a bias because I'm from the 100 Men Black School for Black Boys, what we found is with black males, the mentor most is a white female, then it's a white male, then it's a black female, then it's a black male.
Why?
I don't know. That's problematic. That's a problem. So when I see that, I say, yeah, but who are you talking about?
Are you saying that a white female can't be a mentor to a black child?
No, I am actually saying that they can't, they can help, but that is not, yes. Yeah. So I have to be real and speak truth. I think that a black male also should mentor a black male. I think he would make a better mentor than myself. So I'm just being real, and it is problematic if a white female is the mentor for a black male and there's no one else.
Thank you very much. I know someone's got something to say.
Oh, I know.
Please continue.
My name is Diaris. I'm here with the Tutorpedia Foundation. My question that I was going to ask earlier, which leads into this, to answer this one first, would be 21st century skills. But I think there's a huge question surrounding what those are, because for me, 21st century skills include all of those things. They include self-advocacy for youth. I wanted to know why the young men weren't on the panel as well. Why weren't we posing questions to the youth as part of that portion, especially since they were right before? And I think that that's definitely the most important thing, because once we have youth that stand up for themselves and advocate for themselves, they seek their own mentors. It's okay to have a mentor of a different race or gender or age or sexual orientation if you're teaching the kids to seek human first in every person as the race. And I think they'll be the... And I think they'll build their own high expectations and hold themselves accountable to that. And they'll help teachers be more engaging, because when we have teachers that are closed off to getting help from the students in their class that are saying, look, this isn't how I learn, I need a little more assistance in this way. We have teachers that say, oh, we don't have time for that. I'm going to go with what was on my plan for today. And we need to teach people to be more well-rounded, because we're in a global world in the 21st century and we need to be versatile.
Please continue. Yes. Could you say your name?
Name is Wally Crowder, with Clarity Creative Institute, digital literacy organization. I believe that all four of these things are very important, and I believe that in certain schools, they're all present. So I think that I will have to respectfully disagree with the I agree to a certain extent as far as mentorship, but I know that there has been people who cared that I've looked up to throughout my life. And I come from an urban family, gangsters, all that stuff. So I don't want to say that it's not important, because it's very important to have someone that looks like you mentor you. That's very important. But in the absence of that, we will need people that care, that can step up and fill that role. But I also believe that the 21st century skills and effective engaging students, those kind of go hand in hand when you look at the media and the technology that young people are involved in today. It's 24/7. We grew up in a different era to where there was that 9 o'clock shutoff time, we're going to bed. Now they go to bed with their phones and they're constantly engaged. So we have to find some way to mirror that in the classroom, because they're used to being entertained. So we got to kind of put all four of those things together to really have a put a dent in this problem.
Thank you. Could we move on to the next slide? Now, of course, speak about whichever you would like to. I just want to say that my three biggest mentors were older Jewish men. And they did a great job, I think. I appreciate their support. But where is this whole dropout situation being discussed in your community? And is it being discussed? I guess that's the real question. And to what level? Is it something that's relegated to just the educators, or do you think it's a community-wide discussion?
My name is Cicely Day, and I'm at Place at Prescott in West Oakland. I teach third grade, and I'm also a TTO, Teach for Tomorrow cohort member, cohort one. So right, I'm heading to my fourth year of teaching, hopefully next year. So I'm excited about that. But some of the things I want to talk about is, especially these numbers, is that as me working in an elementary school, we don't deal with dropout rates, but you can look at some kids and you will know, especially some of our African-American males, that they are not going to graduate. And so at our school, we do talk about this. This is a great concern to us, but I think we need to start thinking about what's going on in the earlier years, in early childhood, in infancy, and how we are working to build up to graduation. It doesn't just, you don't get to high school and then all of a sudden you just drop out. This is a process that's been happening maybe since infancy, maybe prenatal care, maybe the parent didn't get prenatal care, and then you have a child that's born and has all these issues, but we're not addressing all the things that start to that point. And also, I have 30 children in my classroom right now, and I'm a third grade teacher. It is very hard to address all the needs of my children when I have 30. I had 31 before they left. I have another student who just left. And in order for me as an elementary school teacher to be able to help my students not drop out of high school, we need to think about things that are going to help them. And having a big class size of 30 children is part of the problem. So I think we need to really think about that before we even talk about high school.
Thank you very much.
It starts from the beginning.
Thank you very much. Could we look at the next slide? And I guess this gets right down to it. And it's going to have to take just two more questions, I believe. But it gets the brass tacks. What would you like to see schools, districts, and businesses do to support this you in addressing this problem? And is it possible? Could you state your name first, please?
I will. I'm a coach. My name is Valena. I'm Williams Jr. I'm a teacher at Pinole Middle School. It's a second career for me. So I have middle school physical education classes ranging from 28 to 48 students. I want to make real the conversation that didn't happen about vitamin D. The California physical education standards ask us to teach children about nutrition and exercise. I know I have some science and health professionals in the room, and I believe that they will agree with me that one of the critical things is, how does the product arrive at school? Are our children eating? Did they have breakfast? It's an economic concern that I have for my students, no matter where they come from. One of my favorite projects is having them do food journals over Thanksgiving, you know, so Friday they don't eat at all after Thursday. And what's really interesting is no matter what the variance in the food that they're eating, they're, a lot of our students are getting empty calories. I want to put this on the board because it affects KQED. In fact, I was listening to it on the way to school, was talking about the amount of sugar in our students and their teeth and needing more dental professionals that dealt with adolescents. We have a crop of children that are not coming to school ready physically to learn. And somehow, I don't have the answer. I don't know even the question. But it startles me when I look at all the evaluation about ADHD, AD, you know, everything. That there's a food source. We got to find, how do we get food to our children so they come ready to learn? And I got to let her know, vitamin D is important.
We have just had two different questions that touched on health. And I want to broaden that out a little bit to ask, how many of you see that the health of your students is affecting their ability to learn? And wow, the majority of people are raising their, some are raising their hands twice in the room. And do you think that the school system has a role to play in making sure that the kids are have the right nutrition appropriate for the schooling they have to do? Will someone please address this specifically? Right here, please. Thank you very much.
I have some expertise on this. I've read up on it for 40 years. I went to every school board meeting for 4 years to talk about nutrition, not just D. Omega-3s, not a speck of it in our school food. You can see kids' handwriting transform in 1 month. Go to the website, goodschoolfood.org, and you will see handwriting sample there in the left margin under want to see a better report card. Want to see a better report card. Omega-3s. I gave my students sardines every day for snack, and the kids got smarter. And then in another school, I was giving them sardines, and the principal said I had to stop.
Could we go on to the next slide? We want to find out, there are some concrete things that people can do, teachers can do, to address the situation. We've heard health mentioned a lot. Sleep has oftentimes been mentioned as a factor that could help out. But is this something that you really believe that teachers have a role or an ability to affect in their classrooms? In the back, please.
My name is Coriander. I teach special education at Far West High School, which is which was created with Street Academy by Marcus Foster, a legendary educator in Oakland. We're being absorbed by Tech this year. Thank goodness, otherwise we've been closed down with the other schools. As far as 21st century learning skills, we need to really teach our youth how to think critically. My first question when I saw these slides was, where's this information coming from? You're putting bar graphs up there and numbers, but I don't know who was interviewed. I don't know who.
Where's it coming from?
Who was pulled from? No, I'm just. My point is, we need to teach our youth how to think critically. You don't really have to tell me who that pool was unless you want to afterwards. But that's what as a high school teacher, especially as a teacher of youth with special abilities. There's also a huge need in life skills, how do you relate to one another? And, we don't have any more programs that teach skills, like that people can go out and make money with anymore. So critical thinking, 21st century skills, yeah, they're getting information from the computer now, and they don't know the source of that information. So we need our youth to know to dig deeper, like these young men here, as they were going back and forth, they were getting deeper and deeper into the issue, which was awesome, you know, and it wasn't disrespectful. It was like they were learning from each other, and we were learning from them, and we need more of that as educators.
Thank you very much. This material is coming from polling that is done in this room through your phone and through your text polling. So these are responses that the educators in this room have provided. And we want to get into what you think is important. And it seems like a lot of people are saying that mentors are important, that these dietary things are important. And how we create an environment around mentorship seems to be an important theme of the panel. What is your question, ma'am? Could you say your name?
My name is Matilde Ortiz Hollander. I am a retired teacher. And very interesting to hear. Everybody is right in so many ways. I think we are missing very important point. Children are not ready to begin school. As a bilingual teacher, I saw so much. I work like a social worker. I work like a teacher. I work like a doctor. I saw everything. And I'm here, and I see that it's skills, expectations. We have high expectations of the kids, but we don't teach them when, how, in all the languages. This is the only country in the world when you get penalized for speaking a second language. You get penalized. I speak three languages. Why the children get penalized and they say, go home, go home. A is for apple. Why don't we look for similarities in languages? It's so much easy to teach. I do research with UC Berkeley. I have done 4 books. I wrote my own book for little children because little children are in my heart. And I believe if we start teaching children to respect languages, respect culture, respect each other, you accomplish so much. You really do. So we need to realize that we have to do some very dramatic changes. The lady regarding the food, she's right. We need children who eat at home, but many of them, they don't have the food. I used to bring hot chocolate for my kids all the time. All the time, my husband said, we don't have any more. I said, we have to get more. I don't have anything for feeding my kids. It's no food for the kids. They come to school hungry. So changes have to happen from the bottom up, from the pre-K up. Everybody should go to pre-K because they have to learn phonemes, they have to learn manners, civil education, greetings in many languages. We need to embrace language, not push away. If you speak another language, go there because I don't speak your language. That's not right. It's not correct. Okay, I am welcome to anybody who wants to speak to me. I'll be very happy. I go from school to school assessing children who speak other languages. And it's amazed me how the only language that we speak here is English. Do similarities in language. I have done it. And it's wonderful. It's a research project. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please state your name, sir.
My name is Justin Castaneda. I am a student at Chabot College, and I'm sorry to upset all the teachers here, but I'm not a teacher. I am a son of a teacher. Her name is Jillian Appel. She's not in the room right now. My mother, and this is what I think is the most important thing for students is family life. My mother raised me and my sister with the help of her father and her mother because my father decided one day he didn't want kids anymore. I have Asperger's syndrome. My sister has cerebral palsy. I struggled through high school for one simple reason. That's because I believe my father didn't care. My entire young life, I grew up with my father saying one thing. That's American crap. I would say to him, Dad, it's too hard for me to learn math. I can't understand it. He would do math backwards. He would get the answer and then find the solution or find the problem and then say, why can't you do it this way? And then I would get yelled at for 45 minutes. I was raised by my grandfather, who was an older Jewish gentleman. And he would always tell me, a Jew's favorite question is why? And the favorite answer for most people is because. And I'm not saying that because I want to make a joke or make light, but I think the most important thing for students is the family at home, because I can't tell you how many times I've been sitting there and parents have come into my mother's classroom and said to my mother, well, I didn't do well in high school and I'm doing fine. Yeah, that works for you. You joined the military. Great. Now they have high school diplomas for military, and the military actually said they're upping their standards because they're tired of getting children that don't know what they're doing, that are confused, that have mental problems. I wanted to join the military, but because of my Asperger's syndrome, I couldn't. And now I'm struggling to get through college, to get the most basic assistance. and I have to rely on my family. I don't think it's mentors at school. I don't think it's internships from businesses. I think it starts with mom and dad sitting down with their kids and saying, how can we help you get through today? Not get through today, come home, and you better be home by this time because otherwise you'll get in trouble. And that's all I really wanted to say. I'm sorry to take up everybody's time.
Thank you.
Ma'am?
Oh, go ahead, ma'am. You'll be next, sir. Thank you.
Well, back to the numbers and the charts and stuff. I just wondered who set the categories, because those wouldn't be the things that... And then the question, the text question, is it dropout rates start in 7th grade or 9th grade? Like somebody else said, it starts in preschool. You know, and so I think there's a lot more. I mean, I just wonder. And I have to say, I came kind of skeptical. Bill Gates Foundation, if they're footing the bill, who's framing this conversation? And, you know, this community, we need to be the ones to have our voices heard and say what are the important elements to be considered.
Right on. Get that. Record that. She just said what is important to her. Sir, go ahead.
So one thing that I think is really interesting, and I just walked in the conversation not too long ago, but looking at all these questions, and I think it brings up a lot, and I don't know if answering one of them or addressing one of them is a panacea, but I think aesthetics is a big thing. I think the lens in which we view all of these things is extremely important. We could talk about family support. We could talk about mentorship, internships, et cetera. We could even talk about folks coming in who aren't eating. I grew up in East Oakland. I don't know if someone offered me some sardines if I would have ate them. and just being honest. Give me a month. but in terms of aesthetics, you know, we can look at the lens in which the people who are teaching us are giving us the information. And we can't expect for folks to get it at home. The primary role at home is to make sure that folks have the basic essentials of survival. And the primary function of a school is to make sure that folks are getting educated. And so looking at the latter half of the last bar graph that you had when talking about internships and mentorship and then talking about family support, I think those are really, really important things to focus on. I feel like if you can get family support and tie family into creating systems and policy, you can start to address some of those aesthetics and cultural differences and see that there's connections more than there are differences. I think that working with young people, I'm an intervention coordinator at Encino High School in Alameda, and a lot of my young folks, they're looking for things to do constructively during the summertime, but they don't have any opportunities. And if they can't get those opportunities at school in a class of 35, having a mentor and having an internship and having some one-on-one intimate time with an adult who has best interests and might be showing them some things that they may not have seen before in exposure, I think those things are critically important as well.
And I'm a parent and student coach. I teach parents and students how to get to college. I thank you that this is for teachers. However, I think we put a little bit too much responsibility on teachers. It takes a village to raise a child. I haven't heard that conversation in this room, and we need that for the 21st century. We have done everything we can possibly do to educate our children, and it's not working. So that means that we're going to have to do far more. And it's going to take the community. It's going to take everybody pulling together and saying that we are going to invest, the word invest, I didn't hear it today, in our students because they are our future leaders, whether we want them to be or not. Because someone in here is housing the next president of these United States of America. Someone is housing a congressman or congresswoman. Someone is housing the next mayor. And in order for us to get those children there, it's going to take all of us not saying that's not going to work, but no, everything that we talk about works. The vitamin D, all of it. Having that mentorship, and another thing, why isn't the child the center? If they're going to go to school, how come they're not sitting at the table when we talk about their education? That's all I want to say for now.
Good evening. One thing I like to say is what I haven't heard is we did not talk about mental health. We could talk about curriculum, mentorship, but the basic things that we're missing in the school district right now, and not just in Oakland, we're talking about across the country, is a mental health or a therapist that let these kids, someone the kids can relate to and deal with the issues that they're going through every day. You got kids, as young ladies out there prostituting. You got guys and the mothers leave them at the house and they have to grow up fast. You got them out here selling drugs. You got a situation happened a couple of weeks ago in Detroit because the mother did not want her son to go out to join the hangout with the gang, so he decided to kill his mother. So you got middle, so that wasn't a curriculum. That wasn't vitamins. That wasn't a healthy food. That was just a mental health issue that this kid is dealing with. So my question to the teachers and what the teachers need, as well as themselves, is we need a mental health therapist in the school, and they need a therapist for the teachers that are dealing with their situation as well.
Okay, I'm pretty sure everybody here has already heard me speak up there, but I just wanted to say one thing, that every single issue that has been raised here in this forum is true. Every single issue is true. And if some of them come as a surprise, then that's because we aren't talking to the people that are actually on ground zero every single day, dealing with all of these issues, dealing with the curriculum, dealing with issues of prostitution, dealing with being hungry, dealing with not knowing, you know, how to do this assignment, not knowing if they're going to be safe when they get home. The youth are the ones who are dealing with these issues. The youth are the ones who are growing up and who are going to have to make decisions about the future. And if we don't listen to what the youth have to say, whether we like it or not, and honestly, I think that's the biggest issue. Sometimes we don't like what we hear. Sometimes we don't want our baby girl or our baby boy to be tainted. And honestly, it's going to happen sooner or later. And exposing children to the issues of nutrition, to the issues of violence, to all of these issues, not exposing them, but getting their input, because we as youth, we have a unique perspective. The generation that we grew up in now is not the same generation as the ones before us, the ones before them, and the ones before them. And the issue, in my opinion, my not-so-humble opinion, is culture. The culture of treating youth as if they don't have the capacity to engage in dialogue and to engage in these types of discussions is the biggest reason why some youth just totally disconnect. And it's the biggest reason why some youth who maybe are connected are not getting what they could be getting out of this system. The system is a system, in my opinion, that doesn't value the contributions of its participants, of its main participants, and that's the youth. So I feel that the numbers that you have up there, while yes, they are important, did they come from students? Did the students tell you that, hey, you know, some of these things you have up here on here may not even apply to my school? Some of these things, like, we don't even think about. Like, we're still trying to figure out how we're going to learn in this classroom when we have lights that don't even work. Like, when we have teachers that aren't even able to come to school because maybe they weren't fired, but maybe the structure of the school, they had issues going on. We didn't have a substitute that knew how to do anything. Like, there's issues that aren't being brought up because people don't know. People aren't in classrooms every day. I'm going to say this at the risk of sounding indignant or just straight up repulsive. You are not in the classroom every single day as a student. You're in the classroom as a teacher. You have a unique perspective. There are at least 30 other unique perspectives within those same classrooms that you're in. And if you are able to pull from those unique perspectives, you would gain a cohesive whole. You know, flies have multiple eyes for a reason. They can see all the little fragments of things that we don't notice. So in order to kind of mirror that, we have to listen to the voices of the youth. Because as I said earlier, youth have potential knowledge and intelligence, and we need to turn that into kinetic knowledge and intelligence. And the only way you can do that is by empowering them and pulling them from out of the shell that you've put them in the first place.
We'll have time for one more question. Why don't you go ahead? We'll get you, sir. We'll get you both. We'll get you both. Go ahead.
All right. I just want to say this woman who was talking about investing in education.
What is your name, ma'am?
My name is Bernadette Breen. I teach in Oakland. I teach third grade in East Oakland. And I think it's true that we do need to throw more money at the problem and invest in our children. When you have 30 kindergartners in a room with one teacher all day long, that is not caring about children. That is not all about the children. That is all about saving money for your district and for your state. And to even think that you could carry on a class with 30, 4, and 5-year-olds and teach them something instead of just herd them all day is crazy. So we do need to invest, and teachers are so busy trying to do their jobs that they don't have time to advocate for themselves and their students. We really need to organize and make more noise, but it's really hard to get teachers to do it because they're so overwhelmed in their jobs.
Thank you. Sir, you're going to have the last word.
Thank you. I just want to acknowledge you.
What is your name?
Rashid Shaheed. I do a lot of things. I wear a lot of hats. Mental therapy, mental counseling, community education, parent, coach, you name it. I just want to acknowledge you for having the idea to bring this conversation out into the public. We've been having these conversations for a lot of years. And the youth who just spoke, if I had to ask him a question, has he ever been whooped? And he probably could say no or yeah. And me and the secretary at one of the schools today was talking about when we grew up, we were seen but not heard. Anybody can relate to that as a child? And where you, mama didn't want to whoop you. That was the last result. Why do I bring that up? Because what I see in the schools is the young people and most adults, we do not like rules. So without rules, we can't move forward. There's a lot of chaos. And so me working with young men in particular, they need rules. So to graduate from high school is an objective. You can graduate from high school and you may, that's all you pretty much did. So the goal is to graduate from high school. In the meantime, what I'm finding is the children, the young people love to socialize. If you're gonna teach them, bring culture, bring socialization in the conversation. Just don't teach them and tell them what to do, but have them think and have them have conversation. You may be doing that already. If you are, acknowledge yourself, because teaching is not easy. I want to acknowledge the teachers. It's not an easy job because you got to grade papers, you got to prepare, you got to tell Johnny to sit down, you got to tell Louise to come in and be on time. Oh, that's a lot of work. And then you worry about your own self. So I just want to thank you for having this conversation. I hope that we can bring more value to each other because, as one of the brothers said about mental health, what I find a lot of times, the teachers are tired. They're just really tired, and you're pushing through everything you can to complete that day, and then you go where you got to go to happy hour or whatever. Because you need it, you know? I mean, teachers party. Teachers party. I know why teachers party now. It's like you need to let your hair down because you're going to hurt somebody. And it's you can't do it, but it's real. So I just want to acknowledge us all as educators for being in the game because someone told me you can't teach someone if you don't really love them, you know, because you got to know, man, this is work. Because we're talking about human beings. We're talking about the mind. People are thinking all the time. So we're not creating soldiers in our classroom. We're creating leaders, like the ladies say, presidents, congressmen. And just know that when you show up tomorrow in your classroom, bring that love again. I mean, and if you need to talk to another teacher, say, what can I do in this situation? Don't be afraid. Let your ego go for a minute because it's a community. It's all of us working together. You know what I'm saying? And that's because the last thing I want to say real quick is that children, as we go as adults, so do they go. They're watching us, like it or not, the good, the ugly, the bad, all of it. So just be okay with that. Let us be human in this game of living and loving life. With that, Ashe.
On behalf of everyone, okay, sorry. Does anyone have one final question they'd like to ask?
We have a call to action. I want to make sure we get to that.
Please go ahead, grab the microphone, and state your name.
Diaris again from Tutorpedia. I feel like we always get so many great voices in the room and so many ideas, and we all get inspired, but then we leave. You know, so I want to make sure that, I don't know if this is next, but if you have some sort of call to action where you're like, host 5 people for dinner or have people come out after your school and talk about something, but I'd love to see if that's next.
Well, this is a room of educators. Connect, get together. This is what the event was for in the first place. It's not often enough that people with your background get together in a room to solve problems that are community related, and we're so thrilled. I know that myself, I've never seen it before. I want to really thank KQED, thank the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, thank Laney College for having us here today, and thank the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for helping us sponsor today's event. Thank you very, very much. And please give yourself a round of applause, because this is how the community gets better. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a KQED Public Affairs special, the American Graduate Forum, held at Laney College in Oakland on March 13th. The recording engineer is Jim Bennett, and the technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. For KQED Public Radio, I'm Mark Troutwine. Thanks for listening.